My name is Mike Flahav. I'm here in the lookout post number 43, right out in the headland at the original Bramore. Bramore is 1500 years ago or more, it was a promontory fort, and it was used for defence and for meetings. An bruachan in Irish, it means the big gathering place. So all the people that lived in the ring forts, and there was hundreds of them locally, when they were having a meeting or a wedding or a court case or whatever, it all happened in here, in this area, the promontory fort. Or if they were under threat, usually from their neighbours, they'd bring all their possessions in here, their livestock, whatever, a few sheep, goats, Kerry cattle maybe even, and they only had to defend across the bank, across the front. But the whole idea of promontory forts was they'd pick a headland and they'd only cut off the neck of it then, and they only had to defend across that part because there was nobody going to attack them from the cliff side. The cliffs now here are 180 feet straight down, you know, so there was no danger of attack from that direction.
So the further out you went, the kind of safer you were?
Oh yeah, yes. It minimised the amount of work they had to do. You see in the bank now when we're coming in, how big it is, it's probably 20 foot high. But originally that would have been, there would have been wooden stakes, a kind of rough fencing along the top of it to deter anybody attacking them. And a big wooden gate or timber gate as well. Actually, the archaeologists have gone back over 100 years ago now, T.J. Westrop. He makes out there was evidence there was a second bank outside where parallel with this one, and that there was a sort of a moat and water in between. So it was a fairly substantial promontory fort in those days. But there's quite a few of them along North Kerry. I think there's at least 13, you know.
Yeah.
Even the Castle Green in Ballybunnan was originally a promontory fort before ever they put a castle there.
Mike, I can't imagine someone coming in here to get married. It's so tiny.
I know, this was the promontory fort. They'd come in here because it was a big area, you know, a couple of 2 acres. Here, this where we are now, on the lookout post, is that's only going back to the Second World War. It was originally in 1939, when the war started, the Irish government decided they needed lookouts all along the coast of Ireland because there was a threat of invasion by either the Germans or the British to prevent the Germans invading Britain, you know, to getting a foothold here. And for a start off, it was only the army were here with, they had a tinty camp, and then they decided to build these buildings. They were precast by the OPW, and a local contractor then came on, and I said they were precast. They were a bit like Lego. There was actually 149 blocks, and you can see the way they're keyed into each other. You know, you just put them as they were numbered into place, including the chimney there. It's all precast blocks, and from then on, there was a Coast Watch service recruited. Many of them were local. Now there was a few from outside, I suppose they couldn't get enough local people. They were trained and they were uniformed. They weren't armed, and in the early days, if they saw something, everything, you see those pages on the table now, they're copies of the logbooks which survived, and they're in Carbrew Barracks, the military museum in Dublin. I've been up and I photographed all of them. If they saw something noteworthy, shall we say, one fella hopped up on the bike and he went down to the barrack with the information. So that obviously wasn't going to be very immediate. So from 1940, the phone there, that was put in.
There and is phone. That the very phone?
It's not the phone. It is actually a genuine World War II field telephone, all right. But the original one, they took it away with them when they abandoned here in 1945.
So how would they dial? Is it just to say...
Just connected. That was a phone line across with poles, across the fields there. And they just dialed up and they had a number, actually, if you want to know what the number for military intelligence was. It was Cork 2088. I don't know what would happen now if you rang it.
So there's one way to find out. But you know what? It's one of these things that, you know, it's just really amazing and to see the structure of it. And as you say, only so many blocks and how it probably, it served so much messages throughout Ireland.
Oh, yeah. And so that individual lookout posts mightn't have been that important. Well, there were at times. But when the whole lot of the information from the different ones was put together, they were able to come up, you know, and see what the big picture. So they discovered that there was German bombers coming in over Cork. They were spotted by the lookout post down there. And they were coming out over here. And they were going up bombing the convoys off of south of Iceland. They weren't supposed to do it, but this was proof that they did do it. See, you know, it all. They'd have them in Cork at a certain time, and then they, you see, the coast watchers were trained. They were trained in identifying shipping and aircraft and everything. They actually had a set of silhouettes on the wall as to what that was, and they knew by the noise, and they were able to time them, you know, what speed they were doing, you know, and all that.
Yeah, so I can imagine why the bike sending a message wasn't going to be good enough.
Like you said, they started off basic, but they were improving as time went on, you know. They
just
were
like us.
Yeah.
Now, I see behind you as well, you were saying there was a good few lookout points, and there is, when I look here, there's a good few.
There was one out, there was 82 around the coast of Ireland, there was one out here at Kerryhead, and that was number 42. We were number 43 here at Bramore Cliffs. And then there was another one outside, straight across from us at Loophead, out near the lighthouse, just outside the lighthouse. And there was another one here at Kilcoran Lighthouse. Now, Kilcoran Lighthouse closed down on probably 12 years ago, that way, you know.
And what's this one here?
What's that? I've been wondering. That's actually a fairly good story. Kilstiffin, and that's marked on the old charts, and it says there, Kilstiffin, Enchanted Ground. Now, Kilstiffin, I know if you look out the window there, Kaya, do you see the hill across in Clare? Yeah, that's Rahy Hill, but just under the sort of the right hand side of it, there's a navigation by a red one, and you'll see flashing red at night. But that marks Kilstiffin Bank. And Kilstiffin, if you go back to the Irish, it's the English version of Kilstiheen, Church in the Waves. And supposedly, there's an enchanted ground, there's an island there that appears every 7 years and disappears again. Seriously, that's the legend. There might be some bit of truth in it, because Scattery Island, which is the next island up the river, was only formed 12,000 years ago when the Ice Age melted and receded. And there's quite possible there was another similar mound that was left here after the Ice Age, and over time it vanished. But you will see, especially after the storm at low tide, you'll see a fantastic wave that covers over it, even though the water is still 30 foot deep there, you know.
So do you think that's any coincidence that it's near a fort?
No, there'd be no connection. It's just that something saw. There were stories that they saw mirages and they saw villages in Africa and all this stuff out here, you know. Don't you know one thing leads to another? I actually met a man in a pub one night. Jack J was his name, and Jack swore blind that he was out. He was a fisherman out of Bale, which is a couple of miles up here. That they went out one night and they got lost in fog, and they came on a sandbank, and these people came over to him and they gave him whiskey and everything, and they went to sleep there, and they woke up in the morning and the fog had cleared and there was no sign of anybody around. So.
Oh my goodness.
Now that was true, Jack J said, so I believe him. They actually called the pub after him, and I see after him, Jack J.
Ah, stop. Yeah. Oh, what a lovely
tribute. I was a great character.
With your family being in this kind of land for many generations, had they seen anything over the years?
Yeah, as far back as we can trace now, my great-grandfather was born here in 1829. He would have been here, and there was lots of history. My great grandfather actually was involved. There's a story I've written there about the last voyage of the Dron and Jin to the shipwreck, that Norwegian ship that had actually, it was going from Scotland to New York. It had 1,000 tons of coal on it. Actually, the coal. That's a loop of it there, look at you.
Oh my God, the size
of it. Yeah, and it's lovely and polished because it's there with over 100 and whatever years now, and the sand polishes it. But anyway, they were going to New York with this coal. It's a special coal for making gas and to be used in the streetlights in New York. But 500 miles west of Ireland, they met a hurricane. So bad now that it went into the big ship, like with 1,000 tons of coal in it. A big sailing ship with the proper ship with four masts on it and all the sails. But the hurricane, it done severe damage. It broke the masts and it tore the sails. And there was crew quarters on deck in the cabin. They were actually swept off, broken away from the deck. So eventually, anyway, they were driven before the storm in past Loop Head here. They're out, completely out of control. They had no control whatsoever. And they came in there just west of the small waterfall. They were lucky it was there they came, because if they came here, a quarter of a mile south of it, they'd be up against the cliffs and they were all dead. So it more ran aground over there than hit a cliff. And they were there overnight. This was bad weather in November.
I can imagine how nasty it was.
Oh, it was, and they didn't even know what they were at that stage. They wouldn't have been able to take any sightings or bearings as to where they were.
And then, I suppose all they had was kind of compasses back then.
Compasses and depth sounders and all that stuff, or depth gauge, you know, the original way of testing the depth, sounding with a rope and a lead. And they ended up there, and they kind of knew they were on staying solid, so they stayed on board until the morning, and when daylight came, they were spotted from the shore, and all the locals came on then to assist them. My grandfather included, he was 17, which for every 17 year old was landed on for the crack anyway.
Yeah, of course, to see the and, carry on.
Between one thing, they got a rope into the ship, and then they pulled out a big heavy rope, and they all came out, and the captain was the last man to leave the ship. He was Captain Carol Anderson, and he brought a Newfoundland dog under in his arm as best he could, and a little Newfoundland pup in his pocket. Do any Newfoundland dogs around now that could be had the sin? I don't know. But it was a big occasion. The Norwegian consul came on then and thanked them, because they were put up for a few days locally, you know, and looked after and everything.
So no one saw them as a threat. Everyone kind of, no one saw them as a threat.
Oh, no, not at all, no. The people, on that time of the, you know, the west coast of Ireland, it was a regular occurrence, shipwrecks and whatnot, you know. And because usually the prevailing wind is from the southwest, and when things go wrong, there's no escape. We're blown here onto the coast. There was several down on Ballybunion Beach. The Sea Lark is a famous one. The city of Limerick, there were several of them. Sinister was another one. There was another one out here, actually, earlier than that, 1750 something. It was a French schooner. A French schooner, and it had a cargo of wine on it. It was heading up to Limerick. Usually they'd bring wine from France to Limerick, and then they'd be taking bacon and butter and stuff back to France, you know, to get the two jobs done for the... They wouldn't have an idle trip on the way back. But it ran aground, or hit the rock out there, and it sank. And there was a lot of casks of wine floating around for a few days.
All the and rock. Actually, as you talk, we can actually see a boat now out there today.
Oh, yeah, there's a ship out there now. That's actually waiting to go up to Ahenish. It's anchored there, it's waiting its turn. I suppose there's another ship on the berth, and when that's clear, when it's their turn, they'll go up then. Mm-hmm. It is very busy with shipping here.
Yeah. Do you come up here for a bit of peace and quietness and just take
it
all in?
It's a great place to pass, practice the fiddle.
Nobody's
to follow me. The sound is good as well. Better than it probably. Or if it's a fine evening, I go out and I sit there on the railing and I play my fiddle and I turn into seals. They'd be answering me back sometimes. Oh, seriously.
Does it mean so much to you, Mike, that, you know, you're still carrying on telling people these stories, the amount that your family has gone through over the years, and the most important thing is actually letting people know that this happened?
Yeah, I do, because even here now, where we are now, as a child I used to be back here, and I actually wrote a story about it there, and it was included in the book. As a young fella, maybe 8, 9, 10, minding, you see this area here, about 2 acres, as you can see that the cliff is all around. We had to put back the cows here for grazing maybe a couple of times in the spring, but somebody had to stay here to mind them, you know, because we couldn't trust them, especially the Kerry cows. They'd be up. That was before electric fences and all that stuff, you know. So we'd bring them back in the morning, and I'd stay here with them, and I'd bring a sandwich or a bit of bread and butter or whatever, and a book, and my dog, and I'd sit here watching them, and if any of them were inclined to go too much myself, and Phylon, the dog, was his name is the Phylon. He looked a bit like one of the big seagulls with black in the back and then white on the back. He used to be up on the table there, and he'd be looking out the window, because that's what he'd want. He got lazy, putting up his paws up to the window. He'd sit up on the table. I used to be reading a book then, and sometimes I'd read a chapter to Phylon. I think he understood every word.
But those are the memories that you will cherish
forever.
Oh,
yeah. And he's actually buried out there now, Phylon. But that's another story.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you were saying to me before we ever started recording, tourist season is it's going really good for you.
Oh, it is, yeah. Every year it's getting better and better. And between social media, which I don't do a whole lot of, just Facebook, but other people do it for me, because they're putting up reviews and photographs and whatnot. And simple word of mouth then. See, word of mouth locally is very important, because they're telling the tourists. You know, you'll be surprised how many tourists, is there somewhere we can see locally or something, you know, and that's how it works. This year now, if we kind of get percentages, it's hard to say, but a lot of Americans, a lot of Europeans, and a good few Irish now, but of the Europeans, you'd have Germans, Dutch, a lot of Italians and Swiss this year for some reason, French, a few, not so many, very few Spanish. I had a Mexican yesterday.
What did he make at the place?
Oh, he was actually, he was surprised that people didn't hug each other more here. So I gave him a hug anyway for the guy. He would be disappointed.
Wow.
But we get a few from Norway and Sweden, Finland, not many now, you know.
Yeah.
But the Italians seem to be coming more, and they kind of give you the reasons that they're getting away from the heat in the middle of the summer, you know.
But I can imagine it being up here on a beautiful kind of windy, soft day.
Even yesterday, no, it was breezy. Never met about it. Like, of course, you have the sea and what would you say, the energy of it, and then it's banging off at the cliffs. They're fascinated by it, and they have such a great view. They can just stand there and look at it. Some people are almost hypnotized by it. You know, they're watching one wave and then the next wave. You know, they're just waiting for it to hit off the cliffs. And then at high tide, the wave, it goes in, and all the caves, there's about 13 different caves there in that bay, in Bramore Bay here alongside us. And it compresses the air in, you know, and it can only, something has to give, and then there's an explosion back out, and then big noise out of it. Yeah. Even over now, if I'm over in the far end, you kind of know what the weather is like by the sound. You can hear the sound of the sea, you know.
You don't need a weather forecast.
No. Actually, what day is today?
Tuesday.
Was it Saturday? It was very strange. I saw an awful lot of hundreds and hundreds of crows, and they all hidden south. Now you'll see crows, a small flock of them going from one field to another, you know. But this was like a planned evacuation. When did they know the storm was coming or whatever? I don't know.
I must talk to you just a bit about the kind of few bits and pieces here. You already spoke to us about the coal, but I'm even fascinated here with the old candle dish.
The old candle dish, they had that sort of... They had an oil lamp here for a start, because there was obviously no electricity, and in case of emergency then they had candles, and they also know what you have here, the windows, they had squares of a sort of plywood, light plywood, painted black, that they could black out the windows if needed be. No, that was in case they were being bombed or whatever. They also, to just go away from this a minute, the number 43 and the word there was painted, and that's down below on the next headland, so it could be read from a plane looking down.
Okay.
And the word there, it told whether to the British or American or German airplanes that this was Ireland, you know, and that we were neutral. But it also was a sort of an added bonus to the English and the Americans, in that they knew this was era. They knew this was number 43, and they had a map, and they could make their way back up to Ballykelly in Derry, where there was an RAF air base there, and they could land safely there. Mm. Whereas now, fair enough, the Germans knew whatever as well, but they still had to make their way back to France at least to find somewhere to land safely.
Mm.
And there were planes crashed and on Mount Brandon, you know, there was several of them up and clear as well.
Mm.
But that was they were given the, I told you, they were uniformed, the Coast Watchers. They were also given a fuel allowance for turf, obviously, and they had a fire here. And
because I imagine it was long old days here, so that they needed to keep warm.
The thing was, there was about 19 or 20 Coast Watchers in total. But there was two on for an 8-hour shift, so that was six in the day, you know, 3 8-hour shifts. One of them was supposed to be at the rules, the rules were laid down. One was supposed to be here, and one was supposed to be out on patrol. So, and they were being inspected regularly by the army, and the army weren't going to come straight in from the road like we came now. They could come from south, north. They'd make a game out of it, don't you know?
Catch
the boys doing a drop of whiskey or a game of poker or whatever. They were playing 41 probably. But then when something important was happening, all the Coast Watchers would be recalled, and they'd be stationed along different points along the thing. There was one particular week. First off, I'll show you two things here now.
Yeah,
the first one there, I just done that for Blackadden. Christmas 1941. You see, it took over watch Gorman and Scanlon and all that. The shift was over and same day. That's all that happened that day. It took over to me, Denny. I knew Denny. He was a postman about a month afterwards.
And these are the times, are they?
These are the times. That's the 24th of December, Christmas Eve, 41.
Wow.
Right? But you notice that I saw nothing that week.
Yeah.
I'd say it was mostly in here. But then there was a week in May 42, and there was a lot of stuff happening. There was actually half a dozen mines floating around, sea mines that were meant to blow up ship. And when they were spotted, all the Coast Watchers were called back, and they were stationed in different places. And the army were also called in, and it says here, I told about Cork 2088 in military intelligence, and then again Cork. But where is he again? Oh yeah, Lieutenant O'Donnell, he was from the army, he was the man in charge then when the, and there was something, they rang re-details of mines, and then he rang Cork, the military intelligence, re-sinking of mine on Lieutenant O'Donnell's instructions. No, they sank one. They shot it, it was out there, and the army shot it and succeeded in sinking it. They never said whether it blew up, so I suppose it's still out there. So if there's a bang in the middle of the night sometimes.
You know what it is.
I know what it is. But there was another one. The other was a lot of them. They came into the ladies' strand in Ballybunnan, and they went out again. There was supposedly one went into the Grand Cave. There was one came in south of here in the strands there between here and Doon. And there's a report in the logbooks that the locals were trying to dismantle it. And the coast watcher, they found what was left over. But the true story was they weren't dismantling the mine, I suppose they were. They would find chains onto the mine, and they were ripping the shackles and taking away the chains, which dodgy enough, I suppose.
Mm.
But there was another one then that came in on our stand here, just north of us, and it came up high and dry, and the army evacuated the whole area for about half a mile of everything. Cattle and cats, dogs, humans, everything. And they blew up the mine then at to somewhere there, 25 past 9 anyway. So, yeah, 21:25 until the after explosion, the 21:25.
It's amazing the way they documented it all, times and everything.
Yeah, all these logbooks are in Carlbrough Barracks in Dublin, but the problem is they're in book forum. And obviously you won't be able to take them away, so you have to open the page through and photograph. You know, you can't really photocopy them.
Yeah, and I suppose you've seen many ships coming by here.
I have, yeah. All of them. Actually, there was one I ended up me getting on television over it. As a young fella, about 10 again, I think. It was, yeah. There was an aircraft carrier came in here. And there was a big story attached to that because... basically, there was a plane coming from Newark in New Jersey to Bremen in Germany. And the usual joke story about a four-engine plane, one engine went, two engines went. And when that did, they diverted to Shannon and they put out a mayday. So there was another plane flying basically behind and overhead, keeping an eye on them. A C-130 Hercules, but they couldn't do anything to help other than observe. So then the third engine went and they had no choice but to ditch in the Atlantic 500 miles west of here. And one wing broke off when it hit the water, and unfortunately some of the passengers were carried off with that, and some of the life-saving equipment went as well. So they ended up with one life raft that was meant for 25 and it was upside down. And 51 of them got into it. That was 51 out of 76. And there were 6 hours in the life raft. Now, obviously, if you get into life raft upside down, you're not going to get out again and turn it the right way around. They wouldn't be able anyway. And 6 hours before the first little cargo ship came, the Celerina, it was a Swiss ship, would you believe, and they picked up all the survivors. And shortly afterwards then, this big aircraft carrier, it was actually Canadian, the HMCS, the C is in there for Canada anyway, the Bonaventure, it came on, and they were a big ship with more or less a hospital on board, you know, because they had a big crew, 1,000 or something of a crew, and they took the more serious injured on board, and there was only 12 bodies recovered. Actually, a total of 51 went into the life raft. Three of them succumbed, as you know, while waiting for to be rescued. Three of them passed away, so there were only 48. But the small ship, the Celerina, went on for Cork, and the big one, the Bonaventure, came in here, halfway between here now and Rahe Hill over in Clare, and they couldn't go any further because of their size. And we all knew it was happening, they were coming, and... we were watching them from school and things, and the helicopters took off with the survivors. There were only 4 survivors on that, and the bodies, and they went flown to Shannon Airport.
So tragic.
It was tragic, yeah.
Yeah.
I was researching it, and I knew about it like from a young fella, but I was researching it then. I got in contact. I had one of the survivors write a book, and I got in contact with him, Fred Caruso, and he wrote a book because he was one of the ones that went ended up in Cork. They were airlifted from the ship in Cork then to Cork Hospital. And he wrote a book, of course, when he saw Greenlandic, and he said he was born again Irish, and he called the book Born Again Irish. And I got the book, and he for the joke, he changed his name to Fredo Caruso. He was of Italian descent.
Yeah.
So
it must have been amazing to actually pick it up and see his story.
Oh yeah, and I better still, I've actually met him 3 or 4 times.
Oh.
Fred, he was here about 3 weeks ago. He called to see me. Because when
he stayed here since.
Oh yeah, he was here several times, but he was here 3 weeks ago. He, because he fell in love with Ireland, or being alive, I saw more than Ireland, he bought a little place in Cork, and they come to there for himself and the wife for maybe 2 months in the summer. He lives in Colorado, in Denver, Colorado. He was here with his wife about 3 weeks ago. We had a commemoration here in 2012, 50 years after it, and I put a plaque out there at the point commemorating the incident of the ship, the Bonaventure coming in here.
Mike, I'm sure there's plenty of stories that you have from everything you have here.
For days.
So maybe you could be writing your book.
No. You have to write a book, you have to be too honest.
Mike, it was lovely to chat to you, and listen, I wish you a really good season. When does the season end?
It doesn't. That depends on the weather. I'll definitely be open till October anyway. And that was 1 or 2 years I was able to stay open all through, you know. But if the weather gets too bad, it is nice to be open the weekends and at Christmas when people are around, you know. Not the money you make out, but people are coming and they'd like to be back here and whatnot.
Yeah, exactly.
And
thank you so much for your time and telling the story of it, and best of luck with everything. And hopefully we can influence a few people to come out here and actually see the beauty of the place.
Yeah. Well, some people are shocked when they come here and never realise it was here at all, you know. And the thing is, we'll go for a quick walk now, Kaya, after this. You have different views. One side is one thing. Actually, when I'd be talking to people over, I'd advise them to head back to here, to lookout post, but then to go anti-clockwise around, because a lot of people have had it coming to the lookout post and going straight out to the bind and coming back again. And they don't actually see the other side where the waterfalls and everything are, you know?
Yeah.
Now, that is probably, the south side is probably the best area in Bramore Bay, you know, it's fairly dramatic with the sea stack and the... There's a rock formation known as the Last Steps there, for good reason.
Come here, we'll have a look at it, so.
Come on then.
All right, so.
Right.